stature and a fair complexion and golden curls, Morgause. Morgause said, Ah, you too are unworldly, Igraine. You're a queen, and everyone thinks a queen is beautiful. And you were married to the man you loved well. Most of us aren't so fortunate, and it's a comfort to know that other men admire one's beauty. If you'd lived all your life with old Gaulois, you too would be glad of your fair face and beautiful hair, and take pains to outshine those women who have nothing but charm and nice eyes and a sweet voice. Men are like babies. They see only the first thing they want, a full breast. Sister, said Igraine, and Morgause said with a wry smile, Oh, well, it's been easy for you to be virtuous, sister, since the man you loved was a king. Most of us aren't so fortunate. Do you not love Lot after all these years, Morgause? Morgause shrugged. Love is a diversion for the bower and the winter fireside. Lot takes counsel of me in all things, and leaves the ruling of his household to me in time of war, and whenever he has plunder of gold or jewels or fine garments, I have first choice. So I'm grateful to him, and he has never had the shadow of cause to think he rears another man's son. But that doesn't mean I must be blind when a young man has fine features and shoulders like a young bull, either. Or an eye for his queen. I doubt not, thought Morgaine, faintly disgusted, that to Morgause this seems great virtue, and she thinks of herself as a very virtuous queen. For the first time in many years she felt confused, knowing that virtue couldn't be so simply defined. The Christians valued chastity above all other virtues, while on Avalon the highest virtue was to give over your body to the god or goddess in union with all of the flow of nature. To each, the virtue of the other was the blackest sin and ingratitude to their own god. If one of them was right, the other was, of necessity, evil. It seemed to her that the Christians were rejecting the holiest of the things under heaven. But to them, she wouldn't be considered much better than a harlot. If she should speak of the Beltane fires as a sacred duty to the goddess, even Igraine, who had been reared in Avalon, would stare and think that some fiend spoke through her. She turned her eyes back to the young men approaching. Arthur, fair and grey-eyed. Lancelot, slender, graceful. And the huge red-haired Gawain, who towered over the others like a bull over a pair of fine Spanish horses. Arthur came and bowed to his mother. My lady, he recollected himself. Mother, has this day been long for you?
No longer than for you, my son. Will you sit here?
For a moment, mother. As he seated himself, Arthur, though he had eaten well, absent-mindedly took a handful of the sweets that Morgaine had put aside from her plate. It made Morgaine realize again how very young Arthur was. Still munching on almond paste, he said, Mother, do you want to marry again? If you do, I will find you the very richest and the very kindest of the kings to marry you. King Uriens of Northern Wales is widowed. I have no doubt he would be happy to have a good wife.
Igraine smiled. Thank you, dear son. But after being wife to the High King, I don't want to be wife to a lesser man. And I loved your father well. I have no wish to replace him.
Well, mother, let it be as you wish, said Arthur. Only I was afraid you would be lonely.
It's hard to be lonely in a nunnery, son, with other women. And God is there.
Morgause said, I would rather dwell in a hermitage in a forest than in a house full of chattering ladies. If God is there, it must be hard for him to get a word in edgewise.
For a moment, Morgaine saw the sprightly mother of her own childhood as Igraine retorted, I imagine, Like any henpecked husband, he spends more time in listening to his brides than in speaking to them. But if one listens hard enough for the voice of God, it isn't far away.
But have you ever been quiet enough to listen and hear him, Morgause?
Laughing, Morgause made a gesture, as a fighter who acknowledges a hit.
"And what of you, Lancelot?" she asked, smiling enticingly. "Are you betrothed yet, or even married?"
He laughed and shook his head.
"Ah, no, aunt. No doubt my father, King Ban, would find me a wife. But as yet I wish to follow my king and serve him."
Arthur, smiling up at his friend, clapped a hand on his shoulder.
"With my two strong cousins here, I am guarded as well, I make no doubt, as any of those old Caesars themselves."
Igraine said softly, "Arthur, I think Kai is jealous. Say something kind to him."
And Morgaine, hearing this, looked up at the sullen-looking, scarred Kai.
Hard for him, indeed, after years of thinking Arthur, his father's unregarded fosterling, now to be supplanted by a younger brother. A younger brother become king. And to find that brother surrounded by two new friends to whom his heart was given.
Arthur said, "When this land is at peace, we shall find wives and castles for all of you, no doubt. But you, Kai, shall keep mine for me as my own chamberlain." "I'm content with that, foster brother. Forgive me. I should say my lord and king."
"No," said Arthur, turning right round to embrace Kai.
"God strike me if I ever ask that you, brother, should call me any such thing."
Igraine swallowed hard. "Arthur, when you speak so, sometimes it seems to me that I hear your father's very voice."
"I wish for my own sake, madam, that I could have known him better. But I know, too, that a king cannot always do as he chooses, nor a queen."
He lifted Igraine's hand and kissed it, and Morgaine thought, "So, he has already learned that much of kingcraft."
"I suppose," Igraine said, "that they have already set about telling you that you should be married." "Oh, I suppose so," Arthur said with a shrug. "Every king, I suppose, has a daughter he would like to marry to the High King. I think I will ask the Merlin which one I ought to marry."
His eyes sought Morgaine's, and for a moment it seemed they held a terrible vulnerability.
"I don't know so very much about women, after all."
Lancelot said gaily,
"Why then, we must find you the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, and the highest born." "No," Kai said slowly, "since Arthur says very sensibly that all women are alike to him, find him the one with the best dowry."
Arthur chuckled.
"I'll leave it to you then, Kai, and I've no doubt I'll be as well wed as I am crowned. I'd suggest you take counsel of the Merlin, and no doubt His Holiness the Archbishop will want some say in the matter. And what of you, Morgaine? Shall I find you a husband, or will you be one of my queen's ladies-in-waiting? Who should be higher in the kingdom than the daughter of my mother?"
Morgaine found her voice. "My lord and king, I am content in Avalon. Pray don't trouble yourself with finding me a husband." "Not even," she thought fiercely, "not even if I am with child. Not even then."
"So be it, sister. Though I doubt not His Holiness will have something to say about it. He will have it that the women of Avalon are evil sorceresses, or harpies all."
Morgaine didn't answer, and Arthur glanced back almost guiltily at the other kings and counsellors. The Merlin was looking at him, and he said,
"I see I have spent all the time I'm allowed with my mother and my sister and my companions. I must go back to the business of being a king again. madam.
He bowed to Igraine, more formally to Morgause. But as he approached Morgaine, he leaned forward and kissed her on the cheek. She stiffened. Mother, goddess, what a tangle we have made. He says he will always love me and long for me, and that is the one thing he must not do. If Lancelot only felt so. She sighed, and Igraine came and took her hand. You are tired, daughter. That long standing in the sun this morning has wearied you. You are sure you would not rather come back with me to the convent where it is so quiet? No? Well then, Morgause, take her back to your tent, if you will. Yes, dear sister, go and rest. She watched the young men walk away, Arthur tactfully tempering his pace to Kai's halting step. Morgaine returned with Morgause to their tent. She was weary, but she had to remain alert and courteous while Lot talked of some plan Arthur had spoken of. Fighting on horseback, with attack tactics which could strike down armed bands of Saxon raiders and foot soldiers, most of whom weren't trained battle troops.
"The boy's a master of strategy," Lot said. "It might well work. After all, it was bands of Picts and Scots and the tribes fighting from cover who could demoralize the legions, so I'm told. The Romans were so used to orderly fighting by the rules and to foes who stood to give battle. Horsemen always have an advantage over any foot soldiers. The Roman cavalry units, I've been told, were always the ones who had the greater victories."
Morgaine remembered Lancelot talking with passion of his theories of fighting. If Arthur shared that enthusiasm and was willing to work with Lancelot to build cavalry units, then a time might come indeed when all the Saxon hordes were driven from this land. Then peace would reign, greater than the legendary 200 years of the Pax Romana. And if Arthur bore the sword of Avalon and the Druid regalia, then indeed the ensuing time might be a reign of wonder. Vivian had spoken once of Arthur as a king come out of legend, bearing a legendary sword. And the goddess might rule again in this land, not the dead god of the Christians with his suffering and death. She drifted into daydream, waking to reality only when Morgause shook her shoulder lightly.
"Why, my dear, you're half asleep. Go to your bed. We will excuse you," she said,
and sent her own waiting woman to help Morgaine from her garments, to wash her feet and braid her hair. She slept long and deeply, without dreams, the weariness of many days suddenly descending on her. But when she waked, she hardly knew where she was or what had happened, only that she was deathly sick and must stumble outside the tent to vomit. When she straightened up, her head ringing, Morgause was there, a firm and kindly hand to help her back inside. So Morgaine remembered her from earliest childhood, Morgause intermittently kind and sharp. Now she wiped Morgaine's sweating forehead with a wet towel, and then sat beside her, telling the waiting woman to bring her kinswoman a cup of wine. "No, no, I don't want it. I shall be sick again."
"Drink it," Morgause said sternly, "and try to eat this piece of bread. It's hard and won't sicken you. You need something in your belly at these times."
She laughed.
"Indeed, something in the belly is what brings all this trouble on you."
Humiliated, Morgaine looked away from her. Morgause's voice was kind again.
"Come, girl, we've all been through it. So you're breeding. What of it? You're not the first or the last. Who is the father? Or shouldn't I ask?"
I saw you looking at Vivian's handsome son. Was he the lucky one? And who could blame you? No? A child of the Beltane fires, then? I'd have thought as much. And why not? Morgaine clenched her fists against Morgause's well-meant briskness. I won't have it. When I return to Avalon, I know what to do. Morgause looked at her, troubled. Oh, my dear, must you? In Avalon they would welcome a child to the god, and you're of the royal Avalon line. I won't say I've never done the same. I told you I'd been very careful never to bear a child which wasn't Lot's. Which doesn't mean I slept alone all the time when he was away on his wars. Well, why should I? I don't suppose he always lay down alone. But an old midwife told me once, and she knew her business well, I must say. She told me that a woman should never try to cast out the first child she conceives. For if she did, it might injure her womb, so that she could never bear another. I am a priestess, and Vivian grows old. I don't want it to interfere with my duties in the temple. And even as she spoke, she knew she was hiding her truth. There were women in Avalon who pursued their work to the last few months of their pregnancies, and then the other women cheerfully divided their tasks so that they could rest before the birth. And afterwards they even had time to nurse their babies before they were sent to fostering. Indeed, some of their daughters were priestess-reared, as Igraine had been. Morgause herself had been reared to her 12th year in Avalon as Vivian's foster daughter. Morgause looked at her shrewdly. Yes, I think every woman feels like that when first she carries a babe in her womb. Trapped, angry, something she can't change and is afraid of. I know it was so with Igraine. It was so with me. I suppose it is so with every woman. Her arms went out and circled Morgaine, holding her close. But, dear child, the goddess is kind. As the child grows quick within you, the goddess will put love in your heart for him, even if you care nothing for the man who put him there. Child, I was married at 15 to a man far older, and on the day I knew I was with child, I was ready to cast myself into the sea. It seemed the end of my youth, the end of my life. Ah, don't cry, she added, stroking Morgaine's soft hair. You'll feel better soon. I have no liking for going about with a big belly and piddling like a babe in breech-clouts all the day long. But the time will pass. And a babe at the breast is as much pleasure as the bearing is pain. I have borne 4, and would willingly have another. So often I had wished one of my sons had been a daughter. If you'd rather not foster your babe in Avalon, I'll foster him for you. What do you think of that? Morgaine drew a long, sobbing breath, raising her head from Morgause's shoulder. I'm sorry. I've wept all over your fine gown. Morgause shrugged. If nothing worse should happen to it, it is well. See, the sickness passes, and for the rest of the day you will feel well. Do you think Vivian would spare you for a visit to me? You can return to Lothian with us, if you will. You haven't seen the Orkneys, and a change will do you good. Morgaine thanked her, but said that she must return to Avalon, and that before she went, she must go and pay her respects to Igraine. I wouldn't counsel you to confide in her, Morgause said. She has grown so holy she would be shocked, or think it her duty to be so. Morgaine smiled weakly. She had no intention of confiding in Igraine, nor for that matter in anyone else. Before Vivian could know, there would no longer be anything for her to know. She was grateful for Morgause's advice, and for her good will and good advice, but she didn't intend to heed it. She told herself fiercely that it was her own privilege to choose. She was a priestess, and whatsoever she did should be tempered with her own judgment. All through the leave-taking with Igraine, which was strained, and interrupted more than once by that damnable bell calling the nuns to their duties, she was thinking that Morgause was more like the mother she remembered than Igraine herself. Igraine had grown old and hard and pious, it seemed to Morgaine, and she bade her farewell with relief. Returning to Avalon, she knew she was returning home. Now she had no other home anywhere in the world. But if Avalon was no longer home to her, what then? Chapter 20. It was early in the day when Morgaine slipped quietly out of the House of Maidens and into the wild marsh beyond the lake. She skirted the Tor and came out into the patch of forest. With luck, she could find what she wanted here without wandering into the mists. She knew the things she needed, a single root, and then the bark of a bush and two herbs. They were all to be found in Avalon. She could have taken them from the storerooms in the House of the Maidens, but she would have had to explain why she wanted them. And she shrank from that. She wanted neither the teasing nor the sympathy of the other women. Better to find them herself. She knew something of herb lore and of the midwife's skill. She needn't place herself, for this, at the mercy of any other person. One herb she wanted grew in the garden in Avalon. She had picked it unnoticed. For the others, she must go afield. And she went a considerable distance before she noticed that she hadn't yet gone into the mists. Looking about, she realized that she had wandered into a part of Avalon she didn't know. And that was utter madness. She had lived in Avalon for 10 years or more. She knew every rise and knoll, every path, and almost every tree. It was impossible that she could be lost in Avalon. And yet it was true. She had wandered into a thicker patch of forest, where the trees were older and closer than any she had seen, and there were bushes and herbs and trees on which she had never laid eyes. Could it be that she had somehow strayed through the mists without knowing it, and was now on the mainland surrounding the lake and the island? No, she mentally retraced every step of her journey. There had been no mist. In any case, Avalon was almost an island, and if she had trespassed its borders, she would have come only to the water of the lake. There was the hidden, almost dry horse path, but she was nowhere near to that. Even on the day when she and Lancelot had found Guinevere in the mists, they had been surrounded by marsh, not forest. No, she wasn't on the Isle of the Priests. And unless she had somehow developed the magical ability to walk over the lake without swimming, she wasn't on the mainland either. Nor was she in any part of Avalon. She glanced up, looking to take her bearings by the sun. But she couldn't see the sun anywhere. It was full day now, but the light was like a soft radiance in the sky, seeming to come from everywhere at once. Morgaine began to feel the coldness of fear. She was nowhere, then, in the world she knew. Was it possible that within the druid magic which had removed Avalon from the very world, there was a further unknown country, a world around or past Avalon? Glancing at the thick trees, the ancient oaks and hazel, fern and willow, she knew she wasn't in any world she had ever seen. There was a single gnarled oak, old past guessing, that she couldn't possibly have failed to see and know. Certainly so old and venerable a tree would have been marked as holy by the druids. "By the goddess, where am I?" Wherever she might be, she couldn't simply stay.
Either she would wander into a part of the world that was familiar to her again, find some landmark back to where she intended to go, or she would come to a place where the mists began, and she could return to her own place that way. She moved slowly in the thickening forest. There seemed to be a clearing ahead, which she moved toward. It was surrounded by hazel trees, none of which, she knew instinctively, had ever been touched, even by the metal of a druid knife, to cut the divining wands which could find water, hidden treasure, or poisonous things. There was a hazel grove on the island of Avalon, but she knew the trees there, had cut her own divining stick there years ago when she was first learning such things. This wasn't the place. At the very edge of the grove, she saw a small patch of one of the herbs she wanted. Well, she might as well take it now. She might as well get some good for coming here. She went and knelt, folding her skirts to make a pad under her knees for working, and began digging for the root. Twice, as she grubbed in the earth, she had the sense that she was being watched. That little prickle in her back which comes to all who have lived among wild things. But when she raised her eyes, although there was a shadow of movement in the trees, she could see no one watching. The third time she delayed raising her eyes as long as she could, telling herself that no one would be there. She wrested the herb free from the earth and began stripping the root, murmuring the charm appointed for this use. A prayer to the goddess to restore life to the bush uprooted, that while she took this one bush, others might grow in its place always. But the sense of being watched grew stronger, and at last Morgaine raised her eyes. Almost invisible, at the edge of the trees, standing in shadow, a woman was watching her. She wasn't one of the priestesses. She wasn't anyone Morgaine had ever seen before. She wore a gown of shadowy grey-green, the colour of willow leaves when they grow old and dusty in late summer, and some kind of dark cloak. There was a tiny glimmer of gold at her throat. At first glance, Morgaine thought she was one of the little dark people with whom she had awaited the killing of the king's stag. But the woman's bearing made her look quite unlike those small hunted people. She carried herself like a priestess or a queen. Morgaine had no idea of her age, but the deep-set eyes and the lines around them told her that the woman was not young. "What are you doing, Morgaine of the Fairies?" Ice prickled all along her spine. How did the woman know her name? But concealing her fear with the skill of a priestess, she said, "If you know my name, lady, surely you can see what I'm doing." Firmly she wrenched her eyes away from the dark gaze bent on her own and returned to peeling the bark. Then she looked up again, half expecting that the strange woman would have disappeared as quickly as she had come. But she was still there, regarding Morgaine's work dispassionately. She said, her eyes now resting on Morgaine's grubby hands, the nail she had broken in her rooting, "Yes, I can see what you are doing and what you intend to do. Why? What is that to you?" "Life is precious to my people," the woman said, "though we neither bear nor die as easily as your kind. But it is a marvel to me that you, Morgaine, who bear the royal line of the old people, and thus are my far kinswoman, would seek to cast away the only child you will ever bear." Morgaine swallowed hard. She scrambled to her feet, conscious of her grubby, earth-covered hands, the half-stripped roots in her hand, her skirt wrinkled with kneeling on the damp, muddy earth, like a goose girl before a high priestess. She said defiantly, "What makes you say that? I'm still young.
Why do you think that if I cast this child forth, I should not bear a dozen others? I had forgotten that where the fairy blood is dilute, the sight comes down to you maimed and incomplete, the stranger said. Let it be enough to say, I have seen. Think twice, Morgaine, before you refuse what the goddess sent you from the king's stag. Suddenly Morgaine began to weep again. She said, stammering, I don't want it. I didn't want it. Why did the goddess do this to me? If you come from her, can you answer that then? The strange woman looked at her sadly. I am not the goddess, Morgaine, nor even her emissary. My kind know neither gods nor goddesses, but only the breast of our mother who is beneath our feet and above our heads, from whom we come and to whom we go when our time is ended. Therefore we cherish life and weep to see it cast aside. She stepped forward and took the root from Morgaine's hand. She said, You do not want this, and cast it aside on the ground. What is your name? Morgaine cried. What is this place? You could not say my name in your language, said the lady. And suddenly Morgaine wondered what language they were speaking. As for this place, it is the Hazel Grove, and it is what it is. It leads to my place, and the path yonder, she pointed, will lead you to your own place, in Avalon. Morgaine followed her pointing finger with her eyes. Yes, there was a path there. She would have taken oath it hadn't been there when she came first into the grove. The lady was still standing near her. There was a strange smell to her, not the strong smell of an unwashed body, as it had been with the old tribal priestess, but a curious, indefinable fragrance, as of some unfamiliar herb or leaf, a strange, fresh, almost bitter scent. Like the ritual herbs for the sight, it made Morgaine feel as if there was some spell on her eyes, so that she saw more than she saw at any other time, as if everything was new and clean, not the ordinary things of every day. The lady said in a low, mesmerizing voice, You can stay here with me if you will. I will make you sleep so that you will bear your child without pain, and I will take him for the strong life that is in him, and he will live longer than he would with your kind. For I see a destiny for him in your world. He will try to do good, and like most of your kind, he will do only harm. But if he stays here among my people, he will live long and long, almost, you would say, forever. Perhaps a magician or an enchanter among us, living with trees and wild things that were never tamed by man. Stay here, little one. Give me the babe you do not want to bear. Then return to your people, knowing he is happy and will come to no harm. Morgaine felt a sudden, deathly chill. She knew that this woman confronting her was not wholly human. She herself bore some such taint of this ancient elf blood. Morgaine of the fairies, the old name with which Lancelot had taunted her. She pulled away from the fairy woman's hand and ran toward the path she had pointed out, ran wildly as if pursued by a demon. Behind her, the woman called, Cast out your child, then, or strangle him at birth, Morgaine of the fairies. For your people have their own fate, and what befalls the son of the king's stag? The king must die and be cast down in his turn. But her voice died away as Morgaine plunged into the mists, racing, stumbling, briars catching at her and pulling her down as she fled in panic flight, until she broke through the mists into glaring sun and silence, and knew that she stood again on the familiar shores of Avalon. The moon was dark in the sky again. Avalon was covered in mist and summer fog. But Vivian had been priestess for so many years that she knew the moon's changes as if they ran in the tides of her own blood. She paced the floor of her house silently, and after a time told one of the priestesses, "Bring me my harp." But when she sat with the pale willow wood harp on her knee, she only touched the strings idly, without the will or the heart to make music. As the night began to pale toward morning, Vivian rose and took a tiny lamp. Her attendant priestess came swiftly from the inner room where she slept, but Vivian shook her head without speaking, and gestured the woman to return to her bed. She went, silent as a wraith, down the pathway to the House of Maidens, and stole inside, treading more silently than any cat. In the room where Morgaine slept, she went to the bedside and looked down on the sleeping face so like her own. Morgaine, sleeping, had the face of the little girl who had come to Avalon so many years ago and who had entered into Vivian's inmost heart. Under the dark lashes there were patches of darkness like bruises, and the edges of the eyelids were red, as if Morgaine had wept before sleeping. Holding the lamp high, she looked long on her young kinswoman. She loved Morgaine, for she had never loved Igraine or Morgawls, whom she had nursed at her own breasts, as she had never loved any of the men who had shared her bed for a night or for a season. Not even Raven, whom she had schooled to the ways of a priestess since the age of 7, had she loved like this. Only once had she felt this fierce love, this inner pain, as if every breath of the beloved were agony. For the daughter she had borne in her first year as sworn priestess, who had lived a scant 6 months, and whom, weeping for the last time, Vivian had buried before she had completed her 15th year. From the moment they had laid that daughter in her arms, until the frail child's last breath had ceased, Vivian had drawn her every breath in a kind of mingled delirium of love and pain, as if the beloved child were a part of her own body, whose every moment of contentment or suffering was her own. That had been a lifetime ago, and Vivian knew that the woman she had been born to be had been buried within the hazel grove in Avalon. The woman who walked tearlessly away from that tiny grave had been another person altogether, holding herself aloof from every human emotion. Kind? Yes. Content? Even happy at times, but not the same woman. She had loved her sons, but from the moment of their birth she had been resigned to the thought of giving them up to foster mothers. Raven she had let herself love a little, but there were times when Vivian had felt in the innermost depths of her heart that her own dead daughter had been sent back to her by the goddess in the form of Igraine's child. Now she weeps, and it is as if every tear burns into my heart. Goddess, you gave me this child to love, and yet I must give her up to this torment. All of mankind suffers. The earth herself cries out under the torment of her sons. In our suffering, Mother Caridwen, we grow nearer to thee. Vivian raised her hand swiftly to her eyes, shaking her head so that the single tear vanished without trace. She too is vowed to what must be. Her suffering has not yet begun. Morgaine stirred and turned on her side, and Vivian, suddenly fearful that Morgaine would wake and that she must confront again the accusation of those eyes, stole quickly out of the room and silently returned to her own dwelling. She lay down on her bed and tried to sleep, but she didn't close her eyes. Once, toward morning, she saw a shadow move across the wall, and in the dimness she made out a face. It was the death crone, waiting for her, in the form of an old woman clothed in rags and tatters of shadow. "Mother, have you come for me?"
"Not yet, my daughter and my other self. I wait here that you may remember I await you, as I await every other mortal."
Vivian blinked, and when she opened her eyes again, the corner was dark and empty. Surely I need no reminding that she awaits me now. She lay silent, waiting as she had been trained to wait, until at last the dawn stole into the room. Even then she waited until she had dressed herself, though she wouldn't break the moon-dark fast until the crescent could be seen tonight in the evening sky. Then she called her attendant priestess and said,
"Bring the Lady Morgaine to me."
When Morgaine came, she noted that the younger woman had dressed herself in the garb of a priestess of the highest rank, her hair high and braided, a small sickle-shaped knife hanging from its black cord. Vivian's mouth moved in a dry smile, and when they had greeted each other and Morgaine sat beside her, she said,
"Twice now the moon has darkened. Tell me, Morgaine, has the horned one of the grove quickened your womb?"
Morgaine looked quickly at her, the glance of some small frightened thing in a snare. Then the younger woman said, angry and defiant, "You told me yourself that I should use my own judgment. I have cast it forth."
"You have not," said Vivian, steadying her voice to complete detachment. "Why should you lie to me? I say you shall not."
"I will." Vivian felt the power in the girl. For a moment, as Morgaine rose swiftly from the bench, it seemed to her that she had grown suddenly tall and imposing. But it was a priestess trick, and Vivian knew it too. "She has outstripped me. I cannot overawe her any longer."
"Nevertheless," she said, summoning all her old authority, "you shall not. The royal blood of Avalon is not to be cast aside."
Suddenly Morgaine fell to the ground, and for an instant Vivian feared the girl would break into wild sobbing. "Why did you do this to me, Vivian? Why did you use me this way? I thought you loved me." Her face worked, though she didn't weep.
"The goddess knows, child, I love you as I have never loved any other human being on earth," Vivian said steadily, through the knifing pain in her heart. "But when I brought you here, I told you a time would come when you might hate me as much as you loved me then. I am Lady of Avalon. I do not give reasons for what I do. I do what I must, no more and no less. And so will you when the day comes."
"That day will never come," Morgaine cried out, "for here and now I tell you that you have worked upon me and played with me like a puppet for the last time. Never again. Never." Vivian kept her voice even, the voice of the trained priestess who would remain calm though the heaven should fall upon her.
"Take care how you curse me, Morgaine. Words flung in anger have an evil way of returning when you love them least."
"Curse you? I thought not of it," Morgaine said quickly. "But I will no longer be your toy and plaything. As for this child which you moved heaven and earth to bring to the light, I will not bear him in Avalon for you to gloat at what you have done."
"Morgaine," Vivian said, holding out her hand to the younger woman. But Morgaine stepped back.
She said into the silence, May the goddess deal with you as you have done with me, lady. Without another word, she turned and left the room, not waiting for dismissal. Vivian sat frozen, as if Morgaine's parting words had been a curse indeed. When finally she could think clearly, she summoned one of the priestesses. Already it was late in the day, and the moon, the thinnest paring of a crescent, was visible, slim and silver-edged in the western sky.
"Tell my kinswoman, the Lady Morgaine, to attend upon me." I did not give her leave to go.
The priestess went away, but she didn't return for a long time. It was already dark, and Vivian had summoned the other attendant to bring food to break her long fast when the first returned.
"Lady," she said,
and bowed, and her face was white.
Vivian's throat tightened, and for some reason she remembered how, a long time ago, a priestess in deep despair, after the birth of a child she had not wanted, had hanged herself by her girdle from one of the trees in the oak grove.
Morgaine? Was it of this the death crone came to warn me? Would she lay hands on her own life?
She said through dry lips, "I bade you bring the Lady Morgaine to me."
"Lady, I cannot."
Vivian rose from the seat, and her face was terrible. The young priestess backed away so swiftly that she almost fell over her skirt. "What has happened to the Lady Morgaine?"
"Lady,"
the young woman said, stammering,
She wasn't in her room, and I asked everywhere. I found this in her room," she said, holding out the veil and deerskin tunic, the silver crescent, and the little sickle knife which Morgaine had been given at her initiation. "And they told me on the shore that she had summoned the barge and gone away to the mainland. They thought she went by your orders."
Vivian drew a long breath, reached out and took the dagger and crescent from the priestess. She looked at the food on the table, and a terrible sense of weakness assailed her. She sat down and quickly ate some bread and drank a cup of water from the holy well. Then she said, "It is not your fault. I'm sorry I spoke harshly to you." She stood with her hand on Morgaine's little knife, and for the first time in her life, as she looked down at her hand, she saw the pulsing of the vein there, and thought how easily she could draw the knife across it and watch her life spurt forth. Then would the death crone have come for me and not for Morgaine. If she must have blood, let her have mine.
But Morgaine had left the knife. She wouldn't hang herself or cut her wrists.
She had, no doubt, gone to her mother for comfort and counsel. She would come back one day.
And if not, it was in the hands of the goddess.
When she was alone again, she went out of her house, and by the pale shimmer of the newborn moon, climbed along the path to her mirror. "Arthur is crowned and a king," she thought. "All that I have wrought for in the last 20 years has come to pass. Yet I am here alone and bereft. Let it be as the goddess wills with me. But let me see once again the face of my daughter, my only child, before I die. Let me know that it will be well with her. Mother, in your name." But the face of the mirror showed only silence and shadows. And behind and through it all, a sword in the hands of her own son, Balin. Morgaine speaks. "The little dark oarsmen hadn't looked twice at me. They were used to Vivian's comings and goings in such garb as she chose, and whatever a priestess chose to do was good in their eyes. None of them presumed to speak to me, and as for me, I kept my face resolutely turned to the outside world.
I could have stolen from Avalon by the hidden path. This way, taking the boat, Vivian was sure to hear that I had gone forth. But even to myself, I was afraid to admit the fear that kept me from the hidden path. That my steps would take me not to the mainland, but to that unknown country where strange flowers and trees grew untouched by mankind, and the sun shone never. And the mocking eyes of the fairy woman saw clearly into my very soul. I still bore the herbs, tied in a little pouch at my waist, but as the boat moved on silent oars into the mists of the lake, I untied the bag and let it fall into the water. It seemed that something gleamed there under the surface of the lake, like a shadow, a glimmer of gold, perhaps jewels. But I looked away, knowing that the oarsmen were waiting for me to raise the mists. Avalon lay behind me, renounced. The island lay fair in the rising sun, but I did not turn to look my last on the Tor, or the ringstones. I would not be a pawn for Vivian, giving a son to my brother for some secret purpose of the Lady of the Lake. Somehow, I never doubted that it would be a son. Had I believed I would bear a daughter, I would have stayed in Avalon, giving the goddess the daughter I owed to her shrine. Never, in all the years since, have I ceased to regret that the goddess sent me a son rather than a daughter to serve her in temple and grove. And so I spoke the magical words for the last time, as I believed then, and the mists drew back, and we came to the shores of the lake. I felt as if I were waking from a long dream. I had asked, looking for the first time upon Avalon, "Is it real?" And I remembered what Vivian had answered me. "It is more real than any other place." But it was real no more. I looked on the dismal reeds and thought, "This only is real, and the years in Avalon no more than a dream which will fade and be gone as I wake." Rain was falling. The drops splashed coldly into the lake. I put my heavy cloak over my head and stepped onto the real shore, watching for a moment as the boat faded again into the mists, then resolutely turning away. I never doubted where I should go. Not to Cornwall, though my whole soul longed for the country of my childhood, the long arms of rock stretching into the dark sea, the deep and shadowed valleys lying between slate cliffs, the beloved and half-forgotten shoreline of Tintagel. Igraine would have welcomed me there, but she was content within convent walls, and it seemed good to me that she should stay there untroubled. Nor did I ever think of going to Arthur, although I have no doubt he would have pitied and sheltered me. The goddess had had her way with us. I felt some of the shared regret for what had happened that morning. What we had done as goddess and god had been ordained by ritual. But what had happened at sunrise, that had been for ourselves. But that, too, was as the goddess would have it. It is only humankind who make these distinctions of blood times and kindred. The beast kind know nothing of such things. And after all, man and woman are of the beast kind. But in kindness to Arthur, who had been reared as a Christian, he should never know that he had fathered a son in what he would call grievous sin. As for me, I was not priest-bred or priest-ridden. The child now in my womb, I resolved this firmly, had not been gotten by any mortal man. He had been sent to me by the King Stag, the Horned One, as was lawful for the first child of a sworn priestess. So I turned my steps toward the north, without fear of the long journey over moorland and fell, which would bring me at last to the kingdom of Orkney, and to my kinswoman, Morgawse.
The End. You've been listening to The Mistress of Magic, Book 1 of The Mists of Avalon, by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. If you've enjoyed this book, Recorded Books would like to suggest Books 2, 3, and 4 of The Mists of Avalon, all read by Davina Porter, for future listening. Recorded Books would also like to recommend The Holy Grail by Sir Thomas Malory, narrated by John Franklin Robbins, the story of Arthur's knights in their quest for the Songrail, brought to Britain from the Holy Land by Joseph of Arimathea. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The High Queen, Book 2 of The Mists of Avalon, by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. This work, copyrighted 1982 by Marion Zimmer Bradley, is recorded by arrangement with the Scott Meredith Literary Agency. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books Incorporated. In Mistress of Magic, Book 1 of The Mists of Avalon, Uther Pendragon, High King of a fractious Britain, married Igraine, widow of the Duke of Cornwall. She bore him a son, Arthur, whose Brito-Roman ancestry and Christian and Druidic heritage make him the ideal choice for High King. He is the best chance for a unified kingdom, one strong enough to resist the invading Saxons. His birth, however, is tainted by rumor of his having been conceived the night before the marriage of Uther and Igraine. As a young man participating in the ritual of the Beltane fires, Arthur unwittingly had intercourse with his half-sister Morgaine, whom he recognized the next day, burdening his conscience and the kingdom with a dark secret. Arthur has sworn allegiance to Vivien and Merlin, the keepers of the old religion who brought him to power. Furious about Vivian's arrangement of the illicit coupling, the pregnant Morgaine, heir to the priestess of Avalon, has left the Misty Isle for the castle of Lot, husband to her kinswoman Morgause. And now, Book 2 of The Mists of Avalon, The High Queen.
Chapter 1. Far to the north, where Lot was king, the snow lay deep on the fells, and even at midday there was often no more than a twilight fog. On the rare days when the sun shone, the men could get out for some hunting, but the women were imprisoned in the castle. Morgause, idly twirling her spindle, she hated spinning as much as ever, but the room was too dark for any finer work, felt an icy draught from the opened door, and looked up. She said in mild reproof, "It's too cold for that, Morgaine, and you've been complaining of the cold all day. Now would you turn us all into icicles?" "I wasn't complaining," said Morgaine. "Did I say a word? The room is as stuffy as a privy, and the smoke stinks. I want to breathe. No more." She pushed the door shut and went back to the fire, rubbing her hands and shivering. "I have not once been warm since midsummer."
"I doubt that, not at all," said Morgause. "Your little passenger in there steals all the heat from your bones. He is warm and snug, and his mother shivers. It's always so."
"At least midwinter is now past. The light comes earlier and stays later," said one of Morgause's women. "And perhaps in another fortnight you will have your babe with you."
Morgaine didn't answer, but stood shivering near the fire, chafing her hands as if they ached. Morgause thought that the girl looked like her own ghost, her face sharpened and fine to deathly thinness, her hands